Hey everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm glad that you could join me again. And all right, so let's just go ahead and jump right into this. Let's go ahead and start out with what's going on as far as children. I did a very short show earlier this week, or video at least, where I talked about how the left are kind of coming for the kids, so to speak, and that was demonstrated most recently in California with their attempt to go sort of gender neutral with children's toys, right? And I'm sure some of you saw that, because that was it's basically an attempt to sort of get kids to not really acknowledge that they're unique in a certain way, to see themselves as just sort of interchangeable, you know, sexually speaking, because that's what it's really all about, is the sexually identification of children. And I did see the way that the kind of comic book universe is going in that direction too, as has been the case for some time. I imagine that at least some of you have heard that now the comic book incarnation of Superman is bisexual. And at first I thought this was just some kind of joke on the internet, but it's not. That's just the way that they're going. It turns out that they're going to go with that, because there is no point at which they are going to stop kind of coming for your kids. And it's been like this kind of constant move in that direction. Because it's like, you know, if you've got a kid who's looking at a comic, he's not thinking in, you know, in some grand sexual terms, or wanting to see relationships, most likely, at all, you know, even heterosexual ones. But instead, they're kind of forcing this into the mindset of young people, which is who comics, at least traditionally speaking, were aimed toward, right? And so you look at this kind of, you know, mantra of the Superman love interest, and that's where they are. So, I mean, supposedly the new Superman is Clark Kent's son, all that junk. Comics have never been anything that I've been interested in, even when young. But still, you can kind of see the pattern as we go. I think Marvel has been significantly more sort of pro-gay over the years, especially in regard to its comics, producing kind of small-scale characters that appeal to that. I'm reticent to call it a culture, because I don't think it is really a culture, maybe something like an anti-culture. But in any case, to appease the sort of gay mafia and the gay groups, they've had these kind of smaller characters for some time over in Marvel that appease that. And now they kind of go, this is DC, of course, is kind of taking it to a more mainstream level. But the thing is about the Superman character, the whole thing was to do strong, masculine, you know, fighting for truth, justice, the American way, and all of that. And they're taking this kind of masculine, wholesome American figure and turning that into something quite the opposite of that. And that's really where we are. Well, yeah, not to appease, but to indoctrinate. Well, exactly. And I think in the past they were talking about appeasing, or were trying to appease certain groups. Now they're coming right out and replacing the sort of central characters that kids have looked up to for some time, and replacing those with characteristics that our collective left now deem to be desirable in some regard, right? And it was the... it's like I've seen several of these different people who are promoting the gay Superman. It seems odd to me that anyone could be like, yeah, this is a great thing, but they are, and they're like, well, we just want to get rid of this straight white savior. And I find that to be particularly illuminating, that that's the thing that they want to get rid of, is as they put it, and that they're using that particular, you know, set of words together there as some kind of inherent negative. Like, everyone would see that and go, well, yeah, why would we want the straight white savior? Because he's straight and he's white, and therefore he's bad. It's like, I don't see that, you know? In fact, I wonder where all the straight white people have gone in the movies and the TV world, you know, and apparently in the comic book world, too. That's what I wonder. Like, where'd all the straight white people go? But in any case, there it really is a... And I know that for some of you, this will seem self-evident. For some, you know, people, perhaps not. Because for some people, it's the first time they've heard of this thing, because some are afraid to mention it. But it's evident that there is an actual attempt to remove, especially white, but masculine figures who sort of represent the kind of alpha male, but in the kind of positive, you know, family-oriented sense, not in the kind of slur, like he's, you know, a gym rat or something. But in the traditional masculine sense, there is an overt attempt to remove those kind of figures that inherently people look up to, and especially kids look up to in different ways. They look to sources of fiction to see good role models. And, you know, that's something that now they're trying to eliminate for kids. Mr. X says no one else is buying it either, judging from the sales, but still not just for kids. Well, yeah, it is true that the comics in general weren't just for kids. There were actual adult-themed comics, for sure. However, the Superman is kind of like as mainstream as you can get, so yeah, it definitely is talking about kids. And remember, these people just wanted marriage, right? It was all about... Now, all they wanted wasn't to affect your kids and to breathe propaganda down your kids' throats or any of that. They didn't want to indoctrinate, they didn't want to spread, because you can't spread it, remember? Because it's just how you're born. And so all they wanted was gay marriage, so they could show their love. This is what we were told. And yet, for some reason, as time goes on, they simply want more and more. And by more and more, I mean more and more access to your kids. That's what they're talking about, and that's what we've been seeing. And so now you talk about it, it's in the comics, it's in a variety of different TV shows, which are banned in what in some ways are better countries, you know, like Hungary and Russia, because they actually protect their kids from homosexual propaganda over there. I mean, so that's where we are. And it's like, when it comes to this kind of sexualization of children, which is what it is, it's perverse sexualization of children, it is child abuse, and that's exactly how pedophiles reproduce, through methods of child abuse and of actual exposure to this sort of stuff as a sort of preliminary step that you might equate to child grooming. That's what it actually is. So, okay, I did kind of, you know, walk on some eggshells there, but... I do think that's exactly what we're seeing. And also, you've got the new Venom movie coming out, you know, Spider-Man's kind of alter ego thing. I'm not sure if he's considered an alter ego, whatever. Venom, the antagonist character of Spider-Man, is apparently going to be gay. So there's a new movie coming out, and it is, and I quote, focused on non-traditional relationships and love, unquote. Apparently, Venom even has, in this new movie, a coming out party where everybody sits around and celebrates just how gay he is, or something to that effect. Yeah, I mean, it's like, this is the sort of stuff that I talk about because it's important, but at the same time, I don't know what to say because everything that I could say seems so incredibly self-evident to me. That I just find myself telling you, like, this is what's happening, and wow, you know? It's like, I can't imagine putting out a movie where you promote that degree of degeneracy and our society actually accepts it. And that's exactly what's happening. That, you know, you've got Hollywood putting out that degree of degeneracy, and nobody, not enough people are outraged enough that the whole thing gets shut down. As it should be. And so, yeah, I find myself looking at countries like Hungary and like Russia, and I think Poland too, that actually protect their kids from outright homosexual propaganda, because that's the right thing to do. Because if a society is civilized at all, it protects its kids. Because otherwise, it's not really a society, not much of one, I would say. Okay, let me get a drink, and then we will continue. Okay. And, speaking of fictional universes and propaganda, we can kind of embrace this theme a little bit more for a few more minutes. There is, you may have heard, a Lord of the Rings show coming out, pushed by Amazon. I should say, it's actually produced by Amazon. And they are introducing a diverse cast with it. So, in other words, you know, Lord of the Rings, which was a very white show, is now going to be not so white. Now, there's actually a lot to this. It's not just the kind of blackwashing, which might be what you kind of think of first. You might think of how they're taking James Bond and they want to make him into Jane Bond and maybe black also, which they've been kind of playing with for years. And yes, that happens. It happens a lot. It doesn't happen in the reverse direction, but it happens in this direction repeatedly. But there's more to it than that. And that's the fact that that Lord of the Rings was supposed to be something particularly special. Like when Tolkien wrote about Middle Earth, the different groups had distinct characteristics to them. Like, the elves had a certain look to them, right? I mean, it wasn't just, hey, they're white people. It was more than that. But also, Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, meant to invent a sort of mythology for England that he thought didn't already exist. And in doing so, he drew from Norse and Celtic and Anglo-Saxon and even Finnish and Scandinavian folklore in order to produce Lord of the Rings. Okay, but what do those different cultures have in common? Right? I mean, they're all white. It's like, white is like some somewhat bad word now. If I say it, I feel like I'm supposed to say something else about, well, it's not like this. But no, really, they're different white cultures. And nowadays, white people are all kind of thrown together as just white people. You're not allowed to do that anymore for Asians. You're supposed to instead distinguish them. And if you can't distinguish them properly visually, you're racist. That's the way our society works. However, there were different racial groups and there were different cultural groups and they had their own sort of mythologies. And Tolkien drew from these. And it's also not really a mistake that the map of Middle-earth looks a lot like a map of Europe. It was supposed to be. All of these things are ignored, and instead when they say we're going to put more diversity in place, they just mean we're just going to drop some random black cast members in for no reason other than to appease the people who are complaining without cause. And I say without cause because these are the same people who wouldn't complain if there was an all-black TV show or an all-black movie, of which there are many, right? Because there are cases where you have an all-black movie and it's a movie about something particularly immersed in black culture. I don't care. Right? I mean, I don't think most people do. And yet, if there's a show or movie that is in some way overly cultural in a sort of European sense, there's some like massive cultural need, it seems, to change it, to kind of blackwash it, I guess you could say. That's what we see. Okay. Pager says, you mean to tell me white people not only have culture but have many cultures? Who knew? Well, you wouldn't think so if you went to school now. They'll tell you about how white people actually didn't have any culture whatsoever. Never mind distinct ones and distinct ethnicities and so on. And it really does amount to sort of a white erasure at this point. This isn't something that I talk about a lot. I realize that in retrospect as I'm talking about this. This isn't something I've talked about live, I don't think, ever. But really, it is something that bears noticing simply because it is something that isn't talked about, because distinguishing different ethnicities and their independent cultures that once existed and are now being erased does represent a sort of loss for our society and for future generations that could have gleaned a lot from those different cultures that are now being destroyed, not just in sort of the world of movies and entertainment, but that have been destroyed in a more active way too over in their homeland due to immigration decisions. Okay, so anyway, yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and move on. Actually, Scribbler Squire says, all the media is eliminating white and Europeans from all the shows and commercials. They have all but eliminated white people. Well, yes, although in a lot of cases what they'll do in order to keep some white people in the shows is sort of new to them. And by that I mean they'll make them into a character that is loathsome in every regard. What they'll never have anymore is the strong, straight white male character who is a lead role and who everybody follows. And frankly, if you look toward history, and if you look toward actual uplifting stories of things that have actually happened throughout history, you have a lot of people who are following a single figure who happens to be a straight white male who is masculine and assertive and has a certain set of leadership qualities that we all sort of inherently wish to follow. And there are a lot of heroes throughout history that represent those characteristics, but they're no longer evident inside of movies and film, because Hollywood wants to rewrite our culture such that those people are seen as in some way inferior as opposed to admirable in one way or another. And you'll see that, of course, in things like commercials too, where every white guy is in some way ridiculously inept or stupid, something to this effect, right? You can never have this sort of white masculine man that is decent and good and fairly noble. It just doesn't exist anymore. Let's go ahead and move on, because I've been talking about this for a while now. Art Institute of Chicago had, until recently, relied on 122 skilled volunteers. And I say volunteers, but these people were well-trained. They were typically older white women. And they acted as guides. And they also acted as school group greeters. So they'd kind of teach children about what they were looking at, and they would show them around, give them speeches on everything. And act like, frankly, full staff members, but they were volunteers and they were completely unpaid. The thing is that the demographics of these volunteers became a problem and was no longer appealing to the Art Institute of Chicago, where these volunteers were offering their services and their time. And in late September, the Art Institute of Chicago fired all of these people, again, the majority of them older white women, because they were white. And so, you know, I keep hearing about how institutional racism exists, especially obviously amongst the left. This is one of their favorite tropes. But in this case, it did demonstrate itself. Institutional racism did take place here. All of these women were fired because they were white, and they were replaced by a smaller number of hired workers who will in turn be paid $25 an hour for their services. So they had all these elderly white women who didn't have anything else to do and decided to go ahead and throw themselves into this venture that they thought was productive and good and wholesome and, you know, help kids understand the place and get some kind of sense and fulfillment from that. And they were fired despite offering their services for free. And now they're hiring people on the basis of ethnicity alone and hiring them for $25 an hour, even though the volunteers were free because they were volunteers. But the other people who were the right color, I guess you might say, who are non-white, they're okay. I mean, you know, it's like we hear so much screaming about institutional racism, and every instance that I come across that's, you know, actually sourced, that you can actually look into and figure out what happened in the case, is all institutional racism against whites. I hear all the time about these, you know, different white people who are being rejected for different programs and grants and so on, and the people who try and act like they might have some foreign blood somewhere in their family tree so they can get an edge up in university hiring practices. You hear about that because there's a benefit in our modern society of not being white. And I hear about these cases like here at the Art Institute of Chicago. But I don't hear about the opposite. And it's like, I really wonder what kind of world these leftists live in who act like there is some kind of institutional racism against non-whites in modern day America, because I don't see it. I will say that the president of the Art Institute of Chicago, who's right there, that's James Rondeau, he doesn't seem like he's, you know, some non-white guy. But in any case, it's like one rule for, you know, one rule for me and one rule for you. Fired a bunch of old white ladies because they were too white. But the people who make these rulings, they never seem to kind of step down from their own positions. It's like the people who are most talking about things like institutional racism against non-whites are invariably people who are, you know, white and who won't step down from whatever, you know, places of privilege, as they would say, that they found themselves in. Repeatedly you see this pattern, because you would think And it's easy to draw this conclusion. In some cases it happens, but you would think that it would be kind of like a non-whites that are making this decision, and they're like, okay, white people be gone sort of thing, because that would be a lot easier to reason and rationalize. But in fact, in a lot of these cases, in probably like 70-80% of cases, it's actually not. It's some white leftist who's decided that other white people need to be banished from their positions in order to make him or her feel better about his or her own whiteness, of which they feel some kind of collective guilt.
Okay.
No guilt says blacks and Latinos actually get more funding in the state in their education than whites do. Well, yeah, because it's possible to actually get grants and to get, what are they called, scholarships, on the basis of them actually being black or Latino. I mean, there are actual grants available for specific ethnic groups that don't exist for whites. And you see that a lot. In fact, a lot of different private companies, like McDonald's and so on, offer their sort of miniature educational grants for people who are, and they'll put like, they'll use some kind of word to mean non-white without actually saying non-white, you know, of a limited background or something to that effect. And then you look at the actual paperwork and they actually mean non-white. Doesn't matter how poor you are as a white person or what kind of troubles you've been through and what you actually overcome as an individual. None of that matters. All that matters is your race. And these are the same people who talk to us about our supposed racism. Christopher Esperval says they're also put in universities that they do not have the grades to be in, which actually ends up working against them. Yeah, I've actually read about that, when they actually, when people get put into a university course that they're not prepared for or not capable of doing, or not possible, not capable of achieving in on the basis of their race alone, they're kind of placed there as a sort of, well, frankly, token, then they end up dropping out at significantly higher rates than they would have otherwise, or of a course that they could got into, or a class that they could have got into on their own merits, for example. Some random bloke says, Tommy Robinson is trying to fundraise again for legal issues. Can you give him a shout out? Well, I guess I just did, but I don't know about his current legal issues. Sorry. Okay. Kyle DeFranco, Italians are historically marginalized even. Well, yeah, so are the Irish and so on, but yes. Okay, let's go ahead and move on for now. I did notice that China is threatening the World Health Organization, which I found was kind of amusing. And maybe I shouldn't, but I did. Because Beijing has been saying that they'll take a strong stance against any form of political manipulation in regards to the World Health Organization's investigation into the cause of the origin of the Wuhan coronavirus. Now, yes, it's still called the Wuhan coronavirus. So supposedly the World Health Organization just has no idea where this virus originated, doesn't know, and is investigating. And in a preliminary way, the Chinese are like, look away from us, you know, immediately. Just look away from us because anything else is political. And it's really funny because it's like, when you look at the lab, right, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which I know we talked about like a year ago or something, it's not just a lab that happens to be in China. It's also a lab that was funded by the World Health Organization, who is investigating the origin of the virus, and also one that Fauci was personally involved in, you know, in funding the actual projects that were being studied at the lab over there in Wuhan. And there's just something comical about an investigation into the origin of this virus by the World Health Organization, the Chinese government being all like, no, don't look at us. It's like, well, why would they? Why would the World Health Organization point at them? I mean, it's like, it's kind of a mutually owned lab. It's a World Health Organization lab in China, in any case. I mean, if you had the World Health Organization come out and say, okay, this is where, you know, the coronavirus started and it's over in this random city in Italy, would anybody believe it? Because I don't think so. I really don't think so. It's just an entire joke at this point. That the whole idea that you could expect fairness or, frankly, decency from the World Health Organization at this point, or honesty. It's like, seriously, they're going to be investigating? It's crazy. Yeah, and China opposes what they're calling political tracing. I'm not sure what that means other than stay out of Wuhan and just stay out of our country because you can't trace it to here. Let's see. Scribbler Squire, Sarah, is the donation button on your website still working? Going to donate, but just making sure because many are being denied service. Yes, it is still working. That's why I handle the donations privately and personally. So yes, thank you. I appreciate it. When it comes to China, though, China at the same time is kind of kicking up its fight, you might say. The Chinese military just posted a video of its troops practicing beach landings and building these beachheads and basically doing drills right across from Taiwan, which is not all that surprising because it's like we've got Biden as the head of the US. It's like China's not even remotely concerned. It's like when you had Trump, there was at least part of them, I think, that was like, okay, he's kind of a bit crazy. Sort of like Reagan-esque in that regard, but maybe more so because, you know, Trump could be triggered a little bit from Twitter. So there was that. You know, he might actually declare war via Twitter. That seemed possible at certain points in time. It seemed like he was kind of doing such with North Korea, in fact, if I remember correctly. But in any case, yeah, that's a situation with China and Taiwan. They're like, we're just going to take it over and nobody's going to do anything about it. Because Biden certainly isn't going to start a war or, you know, we saw the way he handled the Afghanistan thing. So, yeah. And China just seems entirely emboldened. And it's like, at the same time, we're the reason that China is the powerful beast that it is now. And that's kind of personally bothersome. That kind of happened due to Bill Clinton, who they helped to elect and who then let them into the World Trade Organization and thus made them more of an economic powerhouse. And then they gave money to him for his second election. None of this is even remotely arguable. All of this actually happened. It's incredible. You talk about nowadays about the elections, and you had after Trump's election, there was so much talk about the Russians and who they might have funded. But it's like when you look at the history with Bill Clinton and with China, it's amazing. You know, it's like you look at that and you're like, why is nobody talking about this? Well, we made China into a power that threatens the world. And at this point in time, if you really want to break it down, the sort of threat that China is to us, and by us, I mean the United States, it's not even so much their military capabilities, it's the fact that we rely on them for so much of our manufacturing, including of foods and of common drugs, and, if I'm allowed to say the word, of vaccines. So all of those are increasingly made in China, and especially when you talk about processed foods, where you've got a lot of different just random preservatives, like sodium benzoate is made a lot in China. You've got like cornstarch is made a lot in China. That kind of just crap that's in like tons of different processed foods. It's like if they wanted to just poison the United States, they could do so very rapidly without us even being able to pay attention, because so many of our different food supplies are made over in China, and a few people seem to think about it, even though it's easily, you know, our biggest threat. So that's the threat from China. And like a large portion of our medical complex is based upon drugs that come out of China at this point. Hell, the fentanyl crisis largely comes from China. That's where those drugs come from. I realize we're talking about street drugs now to some degree. Not entirely, but yes. And people are about the southern border. The southern border, you actually have mainly other drugs, but over in China is where the fentanyl comes from. In any case, that was a lot, yeah. And when it comes to like, it's like, you know, military power basically comes from economic power to some degree. If you've got the economic power, you can do a lot, as World War II proved, you know? Anyway. Trump was not nuts or unstable, he was a negotiator. Well, he was a negotiator, but he came across as nuts and unstable plenty of times, especially to foreign powers and especially to politicians who were used to other politicians acting in very predictable, calm ways and negotiating in private and not threatening to press the big button, if I remember correctly, on Twitter. So there is that. Okay. Let's move on. Let's move on to Canada, because, enough China. There is a judge, or I'm supposed to call him a justice, but a judge, Adam Germain, who just ordered, or issued an order against Arthur Pavlovsky. You might remember Arthur Pavlovsky as someone who I actually interviewed. He's a pastor who has been fighting against the tyrannical COVID restrictions and kept opening his church. He kept offering services. He kept feeding the poor. He spoke against government tyranny and did so with an enormous amount of conviction. He's a hero of our age. We should have so many more pastors and priests and so on who do this. I mean, I largely think that the problems that we're in are due to the churches being so incredibly indecent and vacuous and cowardly. And I've been speaking about this more recently. It's like, it's kind of a chicken and the egg situation. Do we have such cowardly churches because our society is, you know, decimated? Or is society in the poor cultural situation it's in because our churches are so lacking? I don't know, but I do know that the responsibility to be decent and to set a good example as Christians should at least, you know, be incumbent upon those who pretend to be it in the most flagrant manner, i.e. our pastors and those standing behind the pulpit, ought to be those who have the courage to say, actually, I'm not going to close my church, and I'm not going to stop feeding the poor simply because you say so, and because you're the government, and therefore you have some greater ordinance than God. You would think that those churches would have stayed open. And in fact, a few did, but it was a very small handful. Arthur Pavlovsky was a pastor who not only stayed open, but did so with a sort of indignation toward the government that was incredibly refreshing. He was willing to come on my show, in fact, and talk with a strength and a moral authority that was inspiring. He's a good man. And to bring you up to speed, as I was trying to do before giving you his bio, the judge, Judge Adam Germain, in the most recent case, has told Arthur that anytime he gives a public speech on any topic such as COVID and the lockdowns and the vaccines and any of that, anytime Arthur gives his own opinions publicly, he has to also give the official stance of the government of Canada. He's required to speak what he doesn't believe. So this is obviously a case of compelled speech. Compelled speech that's also a lie. That's what an actual judge has ordered him to do. To give somebody else's opinion as if it's his, or give somebody else's opinion anytime he issues his own opinion. And remember, this is a pastor. What he's talking about at any time, you know, when he's giving public appearances, is on what he thinks is moral, what he thinks is, you know, I guess you could say God-led, right? He's doing what he thinks is right. And then you have the government coming along, you know, in the manifestation of this judge, and saying, no, you have to regurgitate what we say, not what you think is right as a pastor. And it's evil. At the same time, this same judge, Judge Adam Germain, condemned Arthur for speaking out about civil liberties, and specifically pointed to the fact that he'd been on Fox News. Like that was something that he should be in some way ashamed of. And to prevent him from going on a speaking tour, which particularly upset this judge, Arthur is now, by judge order, banned from leaving Alberta for 18 months. So he is not allowed to travel because he opened and operated a church. Because remember, this is his crime, his supposed crime, you know, when you really get down to the sort of meat of it, isn't that he did anything other than preach. He didn't do anything other than open a church and, you know, feed the poor, and preach. And that's it. And that's the thing. It's like you'd think that there was some other kind of convoluted reason why the charges are really in place and all of this, because you've perhaps you saw the video of him being arrested on the tarmac, or you saw the police showing up at his church and being intimidating and trying to threaten and terrorize, which is what they do, because police are always the instruments of tyranny anywhere that tyranny exists. Maybe you saw some of that and you think, well, there has to be something more. And before I interviewed him, I had to look into it because I was like, yeah, maybe there does have to be something more, but there wasn't. There wasn't anything else. It's a government that is hell-bent on silencing pastors. And he's actually not the only one, which I'll get to in a minute, but it's a government that's hell-bent on destroying any church that actually resembles a real church, that doesn't care about state sanction, because it didn't seek state sanction. And Arthur is, you know, a man who experienced communism back when he lived in his native Poland, who fled from that, who decided to start a life as a free man in Canada, ironic now as it seems. He did all of that to be free so that he could spread the word of God freely, you know, without hindrance. And now he's in Canada and it was more free back in Poland. And it's like, you know, the irony is kind of hard to miss. It's like, my gosh, you know, this is supposed to be a free Western civilized country. It was a country that in the most literal sense, people used to run to because they thought that it was free. It's where Arthur ran because he thought that it was free. And now because of this power mad judge who's acting as an instrument of a power mad government, he's got restrictions on his travel. He's being told not only what he can say, but also in addition to limits on what he can say, they're also saying, no, you have to say these words. You are compelled to say these words. It's like, kneel before me. That kind of thing. In fact, they did do that, of course, on the highway, in the more literal sense. But that's where we are. Fortis King says, churches are little more than social clubs. It has become that way, sadly enough. Like I was saying, there are very few modern churches that bear to be called churches, that ought to be called churches. Because nowadays, I mean, look at how many we're just willing to shut down. It's like, did they really believe or not? Like, because, I mean, seriously, if you actually believe that you have a calling from God, is what most pastors will tell you, that they had some calling that caused them to believe that this was the path that they should take, and that they had this mission to spread the word. That's what 90-something percent of pastors will tell you. Okay, if you accept that, and then they're willing to just shut down because there's some government edict, and it's like, well, what about those who, throughout the darkest days of the Soviet Union, those real pastors actually went in to those into the Soviet Union to actually try and reach those people and give them that access to Christianity back then? It's like, how does that compare nowadays to people who are like, well, we've got this city ordinance in place, so there we go. What are we going to do? It's like, what do you mean, what are you going to do? it's just like, and of course, I get it. Like, most of the churches, at least in the United States, are doing it for their tax status. They're like, well, you know, we've got our 501 status, and, you know, so we're tax exempt if we stay quiet on any political topic. And so because of that, we care more about being tax free than we do about, frankly, anything else. Which is what they're saying. I mean, when they're saying, well, we care about our tax status and therefore we can't speak about politics, that means we care about our tax status so much that we will bend the knee to the government, avoid any topics of relevancy in the modern age, regardless of, you know, how important they are, that we kind of guide our flock, so to speak, doesn't matter, we'll surrender it all for the money. And that's what's been done in the modern church. It's an absolute travesty, it really is. And that came about, it was as a result of the Johnson Amendment, if you want to look it up, that prohibited such churches from speaking on political issues or from being, you know, partisan if they want to stay tax exempt. There are a few churches that decided, you know what, I don't care about the tax exempt status, we're just going to do our thing, we're going to preach, and we'll just pay taxes because it's worth it. You know, there are a few, but it really is like a handful. There's another church we're going to talk about though in Canada. Hold on. So I was speaking so fast, I was starting to lose my voice. In New Brunswick, Canada, where police officers and health officials detained a pastor called Cody Butler at his family church, Tabernacle Family Church, because he had too many people there at the Canadian Thanksgiving, which I think is October 11th, but it might be October 12th. Sorry, Canadians. But in any case, he had too many people show up at the Thanksgiving, and therefore it ran afoul of the COVID restrictions. And as a result of that, he was arrested and held. And at the same time, they padlocked the church, these police did, and posted a closure notice on the church, effectively shutting down the church, which didn't just prevent the Sunday services, which would be one thing and would be wrong, but also prevented every function of the church too, because this was a church, and like a lot of churches, they also had mental health programs, they had community feeding programs where they, you know, fed the poor as they're supposed to, and all of that, and all of these services are at the same time shut down. But don't worry, it's for everyone's health. It's like, what health? You know, it's like people are starving and killing themselves because of the padlock, you know, but the padlock is there for everyone's health. It's just, yeah, it's kind of insane. Alan Kidd says, our church never shut down, even when the state mandated it. But in our area, the deep south, most are still shut down, but most churches today preach another Christ and another gospel. Yes, it's absolutely true. I mean, congratulations on having a church that's decent and which didn't shut down. I know that I actually found some kind of silver lining in the shutdowns at one point, because it was like, well, you can kind of find the churches and you can see which ones are still open, and you're like, hey, maybe there's a decent one. Maybe it'll save you some time, because, you know, in a normal year, finding a decent church is hard because there's only, you know, so many Sundays in a week, and you end up having to try and go from one to the other to figure out what their deal is and just how bad they are in what ways. So it was kind of a silver lining to some people. I've actually had, you know, emails from people writing to me saying, well, at least we found the decent church because all the others were shut down. It's like, okay, you know, good for you. Okay. Let's see. All right, I'm gonna move on for now. I'll just read your guys' comments. Fortis says, I gave up finding a decent church. A lot of people did. I mean, a lot of people have given up, and it's a shame, because I do think there is value in finding other Christian people with whom you can associate. Heck, there's value in having a good pastor and in listening to a decent service. That there really is a good value in that for you. And I don't mean that in the monetary sense either, as most of the churches do. Sorry, there's an irony there. But I do think there is an inherent good there. I do, and I find it depressing that there are so few Christian communities, or there is such little Christian community now, as a result of the fact that people have become alienated with the churches because the churches are so bad. Yeah, Ferret says home churches. Well, I think those are going to start taking off. I think that as we start to move toward a more dark society, I think as things start to fall apart at the sort of mainstream level, I think you're going to start seeing things more like home churches and, you know, private gatherings that are meant to be a sort of service. I think you're going to see more of that. And I don't know, maybe it won't be so bad. Maybe there'll be something beneficial about that that's more like what you had in the sort of older times, where there was actual communion. I mean, communion of the sort of intergathering sort of sense. I do think that there is something to be gained from that. All right, anyway, I am going to move on for now, however. All right, so Katie Couric, who is a well-known journalist, been on ABC for a long time, was on, didn't think Yahoo before that. In any case, she interviewed Ruth Ginsburg rather famously, and that was well-publicized. But then she decided that she was going to censor Ruth Ginsburg because Ruth Ginsburg wasn't leftist enough for her. And this kind of amuses me, because I've always found some degree of amusement in the fact that Ruth Ginsburg is like this leftist icon, this huge leftist icon. And at the same time, she really isn't quite as radical as our modern left. And so for that reason, it kind of upsets them. Every once in a while, you kind of see it. But it's like, at the time, Ruth Ginsburg was 83. And Kitty Couric decided, well, she's elderly and didn't fully understand some of my questions. And therefore, I'm going to just leave those parts out. And it's like, okay, yes, she was 83 at the time. She was also a sitting Supreme Court justice. And also, you thought she was competent throughout the rest of the interview. Right? Else it wouldn't have been worthy of sharing. It wouldn't have been worthy of publishing. But in any case, she, at the time, you had the Colin Kaepernick thing going on, the kneeling during the anthem and kneeling as the flag was shown and all of that. And so Kitty Couric had asked Ginsburg what she thought of that. And Ginsburg wasn't enough of a partisan hack at the time. And she said, apparently, that it shows, quote, contempt for a government that has made it possible for their parents and grandparents to live a decent life, end quote. So she condemned those who decided to kneel during the anthem. She thought that it was, contemptuous. And I just find it so amusing that you've got our modern left that finds this stuff and they're like, well, this hero of ours, she just must have been too stupid or too old, you know? And therefore, we're going to go ahead and censor. And I don't like Ginsburg. I don't. I think there's a lot wrong. And I realize why she's a hero, if only on the topic of abortion, which is, let's be honest, the main reason which these people like her. However, they have tried to make her into a far more partisan person than she was, which is interesting because it's like back in Ginsburg's day, the Supreme Court justices tried to pretend to be nonpartisan. That was kind of a thing. Nowadays, they don't do that so much. Nowadays, they're like, you know, I'm on the right or I'm on the left, and everybody knows it. And that's the reason in which, you know, for which they are nominated and ultimately selected. But back then, when she was selected, there was kind of a tendency toward pretending not to be a partisan hack and even trying not to be, at least for to some degree, except for on the biggest issues. You know, I'm not going to kind of overly varnish the office because I don't think it is deserving of it. But I do think that the societal view toward it has changed in a really in a direction that isn't particularly good. But, you know, Ginsburg was like, in response to the kneeling, she said, would I arrest them for doing it? No. I think it's dumb and disrespectful. I would have the same answer if you asked me about flag burning. I think it's a terrible thing to do, but I wouldn't lock a person up for doing it, end quote. Now, she doesn't seem like somebody who wasn't cognizant in that. I mean, that was the excuse as to why, you know, Ginsburg was censored in this interview. It was that, well, she's just too old. She's not fully cognizant. She doesn't really understand the question. It's like, she sounds a lot more cognizant and a lot less afflicted than our current president. So, you know, there is that. There's someone here in the chat who says, I hate how people celebrated her death. Yeah, I can understand that, though I frankly think she should have stepped down way before she did. She stayed in place, despite having, I think it was pancreatic cancer, and despite the very, you know, last year, she wasn't in a condition to really serve on the court, and in fact, she wasn't there a lot of times. But she refused to step down because she didn't want to be replaced with a man, and she was hoping that her, you know, that she would be replaced with a woman who was a leftist, and so she kind of made that decision, which was absolutely partisan hackery, and was fiercely immoral. I also think it's fiercely immoral to demand that your replacement is a woman, as opposed to demanding that your replacement is a decent person who will actually uphold the Constitution, as is the actual job that you're supposed to do. But, you know, there's that. In response to Tom Rock, I can't give my opinion on the treatment options that are being discussed, sadly. Not tonight, anyway. I am going to start releasing smaller videos. I did one in the last week, and as I'm getting more comfortable with that, with the kind of shorts thing, I'll probably be producing some that I release only on the non-YouTube platforms. that will probably incorporate something to that, at least in some ways, will cover those topics, because I'm tired of not being able to cover those topics and it's annoying. Okay, anyway. Well, as we started wrapping up the night, I actually intended on this being a much shorter show than it has already been. But in any case, I do want to talk about one big issue, which is that there was a... I've talked about January 6th protesters, right? Or the detainees. And one of those is a guy named Christopher Worrell. He's a Proud Boy, and he's still incarcerated. But a judge recently issued an order saying that his civil rights have been violated. And that's new. It's surprising, I guess, that you can have a judge actually say that. And it's kind of affirming, because it's like it's something I've been talking about for some time now, basically since right after January 6th, when these people started getting arrested and incarcerated and then abused. Well, throughout that time, I've been trying to draw attention to the fact that people are being abused in there and their rights are being violated. And increasingly, people have been like, no, that's not really happening. And in this particular case, you've got a judge finally saying, yes, that's exactly what's happening. The U.S. District Judge Royce Lambeth said, it is more than just inept and bureaucratic shuffling of papers. So this was in regards to a guy who had cancer. Yeah, he had cancer, or has cancer. He wasn't getting any treatment in there, despite wanting to get treatment in there. And then he was found unconscious with a broken hand, and this was back in June. As a result of that, an orthopedic surgeon at a nearby hospital evaluated him and recommended that he had surgery to repair his broken hand. Still, he has not had surgery. Instead, the prison and the U.S. Marshals Service has been going back and forth with paperwork, and the jail has been refusing to provide the correct paperwork in order to get his hand fixed, in order to get him scheduled for the surgery. So again, he's had a broken hand since June. And we now found ourselves mid-October, and he still hasn't had the surgery. They're basically denying him medical care, and you might say torturing him with his own injuries and medical problems, including apparently, you know, he, like I said, he has cancer. I don't know what treatment he wanted, but in any case, that's his call, and yet he's been denied that too. All supposedly because the jail has been pretending to be inept at, you know, just frankly handling papers. That's where we are. And it's egregious and it's evil. But in any case, this judge, Royce Lambeth, says, I find that the civil rights of the defendant have been abridged. And he wants the case referred to the U.S. Attorney General, which brings us to Attorney General Merrick Garland. And honestly, that's where the case ends, because I don't expect the U.S. Attorney General to do anything at all. And I don't think I'm being overly pessimistic when I say that, because this is Merrick Garland. He's one of the people who's been pushing most strongly for that, for the prosecution, who's been describing basically anybody on the right as extreme, who's been leading the way toward going after the parents who have a problem with so-called critical race theory, or simply, you know, anti-white propaganda being taught in schools. He's been the one who's going after the parents who have a problem with their kids being forced to wear masks, all day in schools. That's Merrick Garland. He's the person who's referring to any conservative as basically extremist, and it's, you know, his FBI that sent tanks out to arrest different January 6th protesters at their homes, despite them not actually, you know, presenting a threat. So that's what we're really talking about. And this was, of course, Garland, who they wanted to put in the Supreme Court to replace Justice Scalia, and weren't able to, even though they promised us that Garland was a moderate. You know, he was just a moderate. And that's what Obama, I think it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Obama who wanted to put him on the Supreme Court and kept swearing up and down, well, he's a moderate, so you Republicans shouldn't have a problem with it. And in fact, you know, he's shown himself as Attorney General. So now when this case is referred to him, as it should be, I expect him to look exactly the other way, which is tragic. What's more disturbing still to this day is the fact that so few Republicans have actually done or said anything about these people who are still incarcerated. A lot of people think these people aren't even like locked up anymore, but there are lots of them still locked up, still being abused, still having their civil rights violated. And yet the Republicans, you know, who are actually in office have been quiet. I mean, you had Matt Gaetz show up, for example, as one of the most outspoken people on the issue, you know, get denied access to the jail and then leave, and he never said anything else about it. It's like, okay, like, what is that other than just outright lip service? I mean, that's not the sort of lip service they did with the investigation into the big tech, right? When Matt Gaetz and Ted Cruz and so on were all, you know, investigating, and by that I mean yelling questions at different members of big tech, and they didn't do anything about it. Well, that's what it was like when Matt Gaetz and there's somebody else, but I can't remember who it was, showed up outside the jail in DC and said, well, we want to see what these conditions are like. They got denied access, and then they did nothing about it. Now you've got actual judges saying, well, yeah, okay, this is a civil rights violation. Let's do something about it. But all the judge can do is refer it to the attorney general, who's going to be absolutely useless on the issue. Okay. Yeah, I can't help you with your individual symptoms. Okay, moving on. The Overton window has shifted so much that he's now a moderate, perhaps. Well, he's a moderate to somebody's eyes, I suppose. That's always going to be the case. But really, when you have people who said that Merrick Garland was moderate, I mean, that really ought to have shown exactly where these people were. I mean, it ought to have, I think it did for some of us, show that those on the modern left are outright communists. And I know that nobody feels comfortable when you say that. They're all like, well, you can't really use that word because there's always got to be someone who's worse. It's like, well, no, we can use the word and we can say that McCarthy was right and we can keep going from there. Because he was right, because if you look now at where the communists are inside of education and inside of entertainment and inside of the military and inside of the what do they call intelligence agencies, I mean, what else do you call that other than he was right? And yes, something should have been done about the communists. Okay, anyway, let's move on to the, speaking of the military, the U.S. Navy recently, just recently, sent out a press release threatening discharge for any members who refused to take the COVID vaccine. They have a deadline that they gave of November 14th. Now, apparently they are accepting applications for religious exemptions. That seems really odd because it's like, if you've got a religious exemption, what are you applying for? And who has to approve it? And how does that really work? Because, I mean, how quickly do you go from that to the state establishment of religion? Because if you have to have somebody approve a religious exemption, then that surely means that you have the state deciding which religions, right, or which denominations or which applications are valid religious exemptions and which ones are not valid. And in so choosing, what are they doing other than violating the religious rights of some people, or at least establishing a sort of state religion on the basis of what they approve of? You know, which denominations they prefer, for example, which I think is like none. But in any case, and that's what they're doing if they're actually evaluating the religious exemptions to see which ones they like and which ones that they don't. I did see that in the press release that the United States Navy put out, they said this type of discharge could result in the loss of some veterans' benefits, which is evil. And the Navy also said that it will seek recoupment of applicable bonuses, special and incentive pays, and the cost of training and education for service members refusing the vaccine. So they literally want to get the money back that it costs to train the service member. Supposedly that they're actually going to try and do that. I mean, that is, I guess you could say new. That's not something that I've actually heard about happening before. You know, when people get, say, kicked out of the military or something like that, that the military tries to then go ahead and get the money back that it took to train them. And that's just, it's terrorism. That's what the government is doing in this case. They're absolutely trying to terrorize these service members into taking a medical procedure that obviously in this case, the individuals don't want to take, else they wouldn't have to do the threats. And it's just, the entire thing is so incredibly immoral, that denies the sort of any autonomy of person to these men, and I really do feel for them. Deus Ex Machina says it's an empty threat. Well, maybe, but you have to remember this is the Biden administration, so it's like, maybe it's, I mean, it's easy to say, well, it's got to be empty because it's so over the top. But given the way the Biden administration has been, I'm not so sure. I mean, they did put out the mandate that few people thought that they would actually go ahead with on private companies, right? So if they're willing to put a mandate out on the entire private sector, then it doesn't seem entirely over the line that they use these sort of tactics in order to badger the people they consider to be their property. Okay. Oh, and by the way, last week, I believe, I covered the case of how the group Church Militant wanted to do a protest out in Baltimore, a prayer protest, and Baltimore had denied them because they might upset some people. And they were supposedly the city of Baltimore was concerned that some sort of riot or fight would get started, and also because the people at Church Militant had promoted the president's protest on January 6th, therefore they no longer had a right to speak. I covered that last week. Apparently now a judge has ruled in favor of Church Militant, and they will be able to go ahead and do their protest. Because it's like the city of Baltimore's argument though was really kind of extreme, because they were arguing that the kind of heckler's veto, but they're arguing a mythical heckler. So in other words, the stances of Church Militant were to be so extreme that somebody in the audience somewhere would get upset, or some counter group would show up, and therefore, because some mythical counter group might show up and perform some actions that themselves would be illegal, therefore Church Militant doesn't have a right to protest. That was the little argument of the city of Baltimore. And they thus decided to try and prevent Church Militant's, I guess you say, First Amendment right, or First Amendment protected right at least, to speak and to protest on the basis of the fact that some other people might be annoyed. So yeah. Also, in Pennsylvania, the Point Park University, the student there who opposed the pronoun policy of the school, his name is Logan Dubil, he's a campus reform correspondent, and he spoke about how the idea of being forced to use the wrong pronouns, let's be honest, was problematic and contrary to his beliefs, that's how he put it, and contrary to conservative beliefs, that was his argument. Now there's been a petition by both classmates and school administrators to get him kicked out of the school for wanting to speak truth, because he criticized the policy of the school. And as a reminder, that was the, and I'm not joking here, this is what it was actually called, the misgendering, pronoun misuse, and dead naming policy of the school. So that was the policy that the university put in place that required people to lie, that required people to refer to men as women if they so wished, who required them to use the wrong name, and just kind of engage in sort of forced speech and coerced speech. And then on the basis of anybody being offended by your not doing this thing, you could be thrown out of the school. This was the official policy of this university, which is supposed to be, I know it's not, but it's supposed to be a place of higher learning and a place that's dedicated to truth and the furtherance thereof. None of which is the case. I realize that before everyone jumps and says that's not what the university system is. I realize that. However, you would think that they would at least give lip service to the ideal that they're supposed to represent. And they don't. They certainly don't. All right, well, I haven't been feeling particularly well tonight, so I'm probably going to wrap up really soon. I'm just going to give you a heads up. If you want me to, you know, respond to something specific in the chat, now is your time to go ahead and put that in there, because I am wrapping up and I'm simultaneously losing my voice. So go ahead and do that. Universities are good for technical subjects. Well, I mean, yeah, there's always going to be some topics for which, you know, a sort of a trade school or something like that is useful, and I realized that there are some career paths that you can't pursue without a university degree. I also wonder if, to what degree it makes sense to send your kids to them at this point. I really do. I really think it's a bad call. And I hear from a lot of different parents who sent their kids into these systems, their kids who were conservative and decent and Christian, and the kid came out, you know, blue-haired while thinking that white people are evil. And it happens. And I know it's really easy to think that, no, that actually, that can't happen to my kid. It's like, you give them enough indoctrination in that system, and a lot of them will bend. And I think it's just ego that causes people to think, no, not my kid, it won't happen. But it can, and it will. Are there any good schools left? Yeah, there's a handful of decent schools, but quite literally a handful. I do think that Liberty's still worth going to, for example. There's like King's College that's still worth going to. But I mean, it really is a very short list. And so if you are going to spend money going into that cesspit, at least spend it in the right direction. It's like, isn't it like Kingsdale or something? Okay, anyway, I can't do it off the top of my head. Whilst you guys are thinking of your last minute questions and all that stuff, Steve Bannon, this kind of came across me today, but Steve Bannon is apparently being charged, or they're going to try and charge him with criminal contempt for refusing to speak before the January 6th commission, because they want him to go and speak against Trump. Trump was president at the time, so he invoked executive privilege, and Steve Bannon has already kind of talked on that. And yet they're going to try and charge him with criminal contempt. And people, and I've heard some people like, well, why doesn't he just go? Why doesn't Steve Bannon just go and tell them what actually happened and everything will be fine? It's like, well, why would he? Because going and talking under oath only presents risk. That's all it does. And if you're talking to a group of people that hates your very existence, that's simply on a hunt to eliminate anybody who's conservative or traditionalist or a threat to the current administration in some regard, if that's who you're talking to, and you're under threat if you make a misstatement in a sort of Roger Stone style way, because remember, that's what he did. He said something that wasn't the case. Apparently he misremembered something, and as a result of that, they criminally charged him. It took until he was you know, he received a pardon from then President Trump. Of course, that option no longer exists for Steve Bannon. So why on earth would he, you know, go before a panel like that under oath with only risk to himself if he doesn't have to? That just seems nonsensical to me. The people who are on the right and who are like, well, why doesn't he just go? I'm just kind of in shock. I can't imagine anybody would. At least anybody who's sane. Okay, Alan Kidd. Colleges have been subverted for some time. It's best to keep your family in the Bible and give them a good Christian role model and soak them in prayer before they leave the house. We homeschool. I do think increasingly homeschooling is actually going to get more and more necessary over time. So, yeah. Because it's not just the university system. I mean, it's the entire set of academia. It is the case with basically all the schooling at this point, even at the youngest levels, they're exposing kids to the sort of gender confusion. I mean, seriously, because it's like, if you look, even at the youngest ages, they're trying to expose them and over-sexualize them in ways that is tantamount to child abuse, because that's what over-sexualization of young children is. It's actually grooming young children, and that's happening in schools and is supposed to be, you know, just perfectly fine. We're supposed to accept that as just the job of the schools all suddenly. And at the same time, they kind of merge that with gender confusion to try and make the kids feel like they don't have any sort of identity, and that they can, in fact, or should rather, switch to the opposite sex. And then they can be promoted to take these drugs that will prevent puberty, or that will cause them to grow in unnatural ways, and that cause lasting damage, I mean, all of that's the case, and all of that you get inside of the public school system at this point, and it's a gradual system. It's getting worse. It's traveling around the country. So yeah, I absolutely think that homeschooling will be the way to go, more in the future, and yes, already now. And it is easier than it used to be. I mean, increasingly there are actual, you know, like Christian decent homeschooling programs that you can sign up and actually do yourself with minimal effort. It's not the way that it used to be. Unless you want it to be. Very much agree, says Scribbler Squire. They are confusing children at a time when they're just becoming sentient. It's abuse of the highest order. It is, and the trouble is that you don't question the things that you were taught when you were really young. You just kind of accept them as the way things are. It's the way that people are. You don't question what you were taught when you were really young. And you shouldn't have to, because the things that you were taught when you were really young were supposed to be fundamental, not, you know, men and women are completely interchangeable, and by the way, would you like this drug which will cause you to create breasts? That's not supposed to be what kids are being taught in schools. But in fact, that's the way that they're going. And especially that's the case even outside of the US. It's not a US exclusive thing. It's happening at a faster rate in countries like Britain and Canada and Australia. I think that to some degree, the Christian thread that is still part of the culture of America has slowed it down here as opposed to anything else. School is a brainwashing institution. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, in California, the governor is forcing school children to take ethnic studies classes. White people have ethnicities too. Well, that's what we're talking about in the very beginning of the show, that nowadays white people aren't supposed to have either ethnicities nor culture. They're just supposed to be one big collective that is cultureless and valueless and responsible for every societal ill. But yeah, I had heard that instead now in California there's going to be new classes, which I imagine when they talk about ethnic studies, it'll be something more equivocal to what we had been calling critical race theory, or what you can more accurately refer to as some kind of, you know, anti-white indoctrination scheme. And whenever you are sort of privileging one sort of history, let's just assume that their ethnic studies is actually a history of various ethnicities that aren't white, because that's kind of like the most mundane interpretation of what could happen. Even if you take that sort of mantra, well, by doing that and by not doing anything equivocal for various different ethnic cultures that are European, you're implicitly devaluing white people and making those white kids feel like they're in some way inferior. So no matter how you cut the way that is written, it's done to hurt white kids and to hurt white people. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up, because like I said, I have no voice, and I already wasn't feeling well tonight before I got this thing started. So thank you all for joining me. I really do appreciate the time, and thank you so much.